Good evening. Welcome to Left, Right and Center. I'm Vishnu Shom on the program tonight. With his forces losing thousands of square kilometers of territory in Ukraine and from multiple accounts of his forces having suffered massive losses, Vladimir Putin, the Russian president, today took his rhetoric to the next level, saying that he isn't bluffing when he says that he has the right to use nuclear weapons if the sovereignty of his country is being threatened. This at a time when he plans to hold a referendum in parts of Ukraine, a process the West and Ukraine calls a sham. As significantly, Putin has announced a part conscription of his armed forces reserves. He wants 3 lakh reservists to be deployed, a move that's alarming, not least of all for many Russian citizens who appear to want to have no part of this at all. Before I explain to you why it is that Putin has really upped the ante by showing you maps of the areas which he's lost, there's a reaction to this nuclear threat which has come in from the U.S. president in the last few minutes.
Just today, President Putin has made overt nuclear threats against Europe and a reckless disregard for the responsibilities of the non-proliferation regime. Now, Russia's calling up more soldiers to join the fight, and the Kremlin is organizing a sham referenda to try to annex parts of Ukraine, an extremely significant violation of the UN Charter. This world should see these outrageous acts for what they are. Putin claims he had to act because Russia was threatened. But no one threatened Russia. And no one other than Russia sought conflict.
Now, the astonishing speed of the Ukrainian counterattack in eastern Ukraine has been so significant that Ukraine has now been able to regain more than 7,000 square kilometers of territory that it had lost to the Russians in a matter of days. It really started on approximately the 1st of September, the really fast advance. So here's a map of Ukraine, the areas in the east and the south where the fighting has been going on. We'll be focusing largely on the area marked in blue. In fact, in the area which is marked blue is the second largest city in Ukraine, Kharkiv. We've circled that and we're going to be focusing on that area. Here's a close-up of the area. You can see Kharkiv. And these are areas where Ukrainian forces have advanced. The blue areas are territory which, as I mentioned, they have recaptured. This is the critical town of Kupiansk that they've recaptured. They've now recaptured Izium as well. In fact, it had taken the Russians a month to capture the city. They did it in a couple of days. Further south, Liman, believed to now be in Russian control. And this is the town of Lysychansk, which has seen a great deal of fighting as well. Don't know who actually controls it now. But what we can tell you is there's a lot of fighting a little bit south of this area in a town called Bakhmut, which has actually seen a Russian counteroffensive in the last 24 hours or so. So the Ukrainian advance there somewhat slower. This is in the southwest of the country, along the Black Sea or close to the Black Sea. There is a simultaneous offensive going on in the Kherson area. You can see Kherson marked there in the bottom of your screen. The areas encircled are areas where the Ukrainians are making their advance. Well, joining us now, Shashank Joshi, defense editor at The Economist. He's also a former senior research fellow at the Royal United Services Institute. Thanks very much, Shashank, for being with us. Putin's nuclear threat, how serious is it?
Well, look, I would say that when you have a leader who's losing a war like this and who is preparing to annex substantial amounts of territory so that he can portray Ukrainian attacks on some of these areas that you've just highlighted as being attacks on Russian soil, it is a real risk that has to be taken quite seriously. But, and it's an important but, we have consistently throughout this conflict seen Ukrainian attacks by helicopter raids, missiles, rockets, loitering munitions, drones, other capabilities on Crimea, which of course was annexed illegally by Russia in 2014, and even on Russian soil proper in places like Belgorod over the border in Russia over the course of the last several months. And so it's not as if Ukrainian attacks on Russian soil or Russian claimed soil would be unprecedented. Those attacks have passed without dramatic escalation. Mm-hmm. And to me, while we may see desperate, reckless acts by President Putin if he feels that his war is at serious risk of being lost, it is also important to remember that he has to contend with the fact nuclear use would bring a substantial risk of the very thing he has sought to avoid consistently since day one, which is open, overt NATO intervention in this conflict. And of course, we would have to contend with the response among countries that have been more pragmatic and cautious in their relations with Russia, countries like India, of course, who would also be, I think, alarmed and concerned by any suggestion of nuclear use in Ukraine.
It's almost unbelievable to hear this sort of rhetoric in 2022. It is absolutely unbelievable. Second question, Shashank, conscription, part conscription. What does that mean? What are the implications?
Well, look, I've consistently said that manpower has been one of Russia's most significant structural problems in this conflict. They haven't had enough of it. That's why the Ukrainians were able to find a weak spot in the Russian lines and break through, the spot that you pointed out just now on your maps. So any attempt at accumulating new manpower is helpful for Russia. They need these people. They have lots of battalions, Vishnu, that are operating at about 30-40% of their authorized strength, which is incredibly combat ineffective. So this is very significant. However, and there's a big however here, it's important to understand that the Russians have been conducting what we would call a shadow mobilization, paying very high salaries to former servicemen to enlist. And they've run into the limits of that. So the people who are now being enlisted, who are those with prior military service, are those who least wanted to do so in the previous 7 months. And having 300,000 warm bodies isn't enough. You need to equip them, you need to arm them, and you need to have officers for those units, as well as having equipment such as armored vehicles. And Russia is desperately short of all of those things. So I would be very, very surprised if we saw 300,000 usable, effective military forces within the next 6 months. I think the full impact of this will only be felt well into 2023. And by that point, the Ukrainians may well have made further territorial advances on the ground.
Yeah, because with the snows coming in just a couple of months from now, for Russia to mount a serious offensive and regain the territory which they have would be much more difficult than it is in fighting season, which is now going to end in a matter of weeks.
It is. It's not just that the ground will become muddy and sodden and it will constrain maneuver. That, of course, will affect Ukrainian units as much as it will affect Russian ones, because they also will be confined to roads and therefore vulnerable to ambushes. That's a problem on both sides. It's also that many of these Russian forces are fighting thousands of kilometers from home. Look, the Russian Eastern Military District, which goes as far east as Vladivostok, is deployed to Ukraine. How are these people going to fare under cold, wet, miserable conditions through a winter season in which they are on the back foot, their troops are running short of artillery ammunition because American-supplied HIMARS rockets has taken out ammunition depot after ammunition depot, and militia forces are, the lines are collapsing in Luhansk province, which was taken, as you pointed out, at enormous cost over the summer months. I think it'll be tremendously demoralizing for Russian troops caught in those weather conditions, knowing full well that Ukraine is receiving more Western arms and ammunition, and indeed that Ukrainians are being trained by countries including the UK and will have a manpower advantage by the spring.
This is an eventuality which we unfortunately need to discuss. What would the implications of the use of a tactical nuclear weapon actually be as far as NATO is concerned?
I think that it would be a profound act, because it would be the first use of nuclear weapons since 1945 in anger. And I think it would be in extremely close proximity to a number of NATO allies, right? You have Bulgaria, Slovakia, Romania, Poland, all the way up to the Baltic states. And so geographically, it would be deeply worrying. But what I would say is that we have to ask, what would be the purpose of use Would it be for military purposes, for battlefield advantage? In which case, as we know, Vishnu, very well from the South Asian context, studying Pakistani tactical nuclear options, it is not easy to use tactical nuclear weapons against dispersed formations in ways that don't complicate life for your own ground forces. Yeah. We know that. Would it be for demonstrative purposes to induce psychological shock in Ukraine and in its allies? Could it be a demonstration attack over the Black Sea? I think that's possible, but I think Russia would also have to contend with the fact that it wouldn't then stop a Ukrainian offensive. Ukraine would continue to receive arms, it would continue to fight, and it wouldn't roll down its arms and surrender. So I think we have to ask ourselves very carefully, what precisely does Vladimir Putin hope to achieve with the use of nuclear weapons? Because it is by no means obvious that they would actually deliver the effect that he might hope that they would.
Why is Russian air power so weak? Why is it that they haven't had, that soldiers on the ground haven't had the support which they would require to win any modern war?
Well, there's lots of reasons, but principally this was a failure of what we would call the suppression of enemy air defense, SEAD, on day one of this conflict. You look back at American wars over the last 25, 30 years, and we've seen pretty textbook a suppression of air defenses, whether that's in Serbia, whether that's in Libya, whether that's in Iraq. They have taken out ground-based air defenses, particularly high altitude air defenses, quickly and efficiently and comprehensively. That didn't happen in the Russian case. They didn't practice for that mission. The Air Force wasn't up to it. And I think the Ukrainians were very savvy in turning off their air defense radars and hiding. But beyond that point, I think we've also discovered a really important fact, which is that the Russian Air Force is just not as good as we thought it was. It has struggled profoundly against Ukrainian air defense systems, both short-range systems, things like Stinger missiles, and long-range systems, including, this is the great irony, missile systems that the Russians themselves operate, things like the S-300, things like the Pantsir. These are weapons the Russians know very well because they built them, they designed them, and they operate them themselves. Yet the Russian Air Force has been extremely cautious, I would say quite timid, in risking itself under these conditions, and it hasn't integrated very well with ground forces. In other words, close air support has been lacking. Again, a problem that is true for many air forces in the world. They also lack trained pilots and sufficient numbers of flying hours. So there's lots of reasons, but I think it's very clear the Russian Air Force has shown itself to be considerably less than the sum of its very expensive parts.
All right. Well, Shashank, great talking to you. Thanks very much for joining us and sharing that assessment off the ground situation. I'm joined now by Alexander Kara, the former Ukrainian ambassador to India. Fred Weir joins us from Moscow, and Dr. Tara Karta, former director of the National Security Council Secretariat, joins us as well. Thank you all very much for being with us. Mr. Alexander Kara, how seriously do you take this threat of the potential use of nuclear weapons made by Vladimir Putin?
Well, Mr. Putin has been threatening the world, and Ukraine particularly, with nuclear arms since illegal annexation of Crimea in 2014. And certainly nowadays, it is a sign of the weakness of the Russian conventional military forces, and he is desperately need to, let's say, undermine support of the West, and particularly of Germany and France, rather than the United States. So the goal of this nuclear subwriting is to deter more support from the European part. But I'm not sure that it will work this way. Last week, Joe Biden, during the talk, 60 Minutes talk, said three times, no, don't do it. So he just warned Mr. Putin not to turn to the nuclear arms. And the last week, Mr. Ben Hodges, the former commander of the American forces in Europe, explained a bit that the United States are in position to react on possible use of nuclear force because China, Northern Korea and Iran is watching, and that's why they're not going to repeat the mistakes of Obama administration with regard to Assad regime. And you remember this red lines on the sand that Assad and Putin, his ally, crossed in Syria using the chemical weapons against its own population. So it's not going to work as smoothly as Putin thinks it might.
All right. Dr. Tara Karta, how do you see this playing out from here on? The winter is coming up. Any major Russian counteroffensive is bound to take time. Deploying 3 lakh reservists isn't going to be easy. And therefore, in a situation like this, again, does it even conceivably make sense for Putin to use a nuclear weapon because he doesn't have any other real choices?
No, Vishnu, the thing is, in terms of nuclear weapons, deter nuclear weapons. That's always been the case. Who is he going to use nuclear weapons against? What kind of a target will he use? Will he bomb a non-nuclear state? He'll be reduced to infamy. I mean, he will actually play into the hands of the West, even if he uses a tactical nuclear weapon. He will be branded as a war criminal. That's completely unacceptable. And unlike, I think, slightly disagree with the person earlier, he's been making nuclear threats throughout, which is what the ex-envoy says. So much so, it's a little like, it's not believable enough. You know, if your deterrent is not believable, it's not a deterrent.
He said that he wasn't bluffing.
What kind of a situation? And
so was he bluffing when he said he wasn't bluffing?
No, but
one would hope that that's the case, because in 2022, to be talking about the use of nuclear weapons, it's astonishing, absolutely.
It's absolutely, it's insane. But then the fact is also, Vishnu, in terms of, you know, there's an old military saying, which I just remembered. For an enemy, you always leave a ladder to climb down. If you want to stop, especially in terms of nuclear weapons, you can, I mean, the US and the others are fighting this, what shall I say, this proxy war plus in Ukraine. And then everybody knows it. So this is, can he, but it's not at a level where Russia can use nuclear weapons, for example, against London. It's unthinkable. So it's very cleverly balanced out.
All right.
If you recall, right in the beginning, the Biden had said, we are not going to use nuclear weapons. This is not, they didn't bring nuclear weapons into the game at all. But if now this President Putin is under a severe pressure, and this in turn brings out the danger of leaders who are weak and danger of leaders who are not entirely informed, which we need to keep in mind when thinking of China.
Right.
That is the problem.
All right. So that is clearly the problem. One sec. I just want to go across to Fred Weir. Fred, there are reports of any number of Russians who actually have visas trying to get onto their cars and get out of the country, if at all possible, to places like Finland, for example, because they don't want to be part of the conscription drive. Is that what you're hearing as well?
Not really. And the irony is it's increasingly difficult for Russians to get visas to go abroad.
Right.
But the limited or partial mobilization that Putin announced today concerns 300,000 reserve forces, and they're not even the millions of former army veterans that could be called up in a full mobilization. They're a selected list of people who have special military skills, and so I think that if I was one of them, I'd be really worried about it. It's certainly true that Russia has exhausted the number of people who are willing to volunteer to go and fight. They keep trying to expand the pool of available manpower, and this is a huge problem for Russia. But I don't think their military situation is as dire at the moment as some people are suggesting. They did lose that territory around Kharkiv, but it was thinly defended. And they pulled their forces back in good order. And since then, the Ukrainians haven't really made that much progress, neither in the south nor around Lyman. And so I'm not sure that the Russians are as desperate as some people are suggesting. But there is no question that they want to rebuild their military force. Everybody, even moderates, agree that they did not bring enough forces to Ukraine. They had created a front line that was too long to defend, and that they need more manpower.
Right. Alexander Kara, is it your opinion that this is going to actually stretch on now well into next year?
Well, first of all, I believe we might see the collapse of the Putin regime with this mobilization, and we might see the dissolution of Russia with this mobilization thing, because I do not agree with the assessment on the ground in Ukraine. Ukrainian forces certainly were outnumbered and outgunned, and at least it used to be before we used the HIMARS and other highly efficient Western weaponry. But what we see that Russian morale is low, and a lot of Russian troops are giving up, and we don't see any appetite from the Russian general public to serve in the army in this genocidal war. So that's why I believe this idea of partially mobilizing, which is actually a lie, because even before this announcement by Mr. Putin, there was a covert mobilization, and they even brought some criminals, convicted criminals, to fight against us. They were trying to engage some mercenaries, foreign mercenaries, including its own so-called Wagner group. So they are desperately need manpower to hold the ground, those territories that they still keep, like Donetsk, Lugansk, and a bit of southern regions. And I believe they are going to collapse. So there is no other way for Putin to keep in power but to continue this war. But this war is devastating his economy and shaking the, let's say, support of the general public, even though it was in general supportive of the war, or at least reluctant of the war. But when, you know, you got the letter that you are going to be fighting this useless war for Russian, you're not happy with it. Sure. And certainly it's a blow to Russian economy, because the Russians need a lot of highly educated people, IT specialists and engineers to operate those sophisticated weapons that they still have. And it's mean those people are,
right,
are not
and you know, they are losing
economy.
As you mentioned, those people. I'm wrapping this up now, because I think we need to take a look at the overall developments on a day in which, as I mentioned, the Russian President Vladimir Putin put the West on notice. There's been a reaction from President Biden as well, but let's take a look at this report.
Граждане России могут быть уверены, территориальная целостность нашей Родины, наша независимость и свобода будут обеспечены. Подчеркну это еще раз. Всеми имеющимися у нас средствами. А те, кто пытаются шантажировать нас ядерным оружием, должны знать, что роза ветров может развернуться и в их сторону.
A clear warning from Russian President Vladimir Putin that all means will be used by Russia in the war against Ukraine. President Putin calling for a partial mobilization of forces ahead of the referendum announced by Russia in eastern Ukraine, in Donetsk, Luhansk, Kherson, and Zaporizhia.
Парламенты народных республик Донбасса, а также военно-гражданские администрации Херсонской и Запорожской областей приняли решение о проведении референдумов о будущем этих территорий. И обратились к нам, к России, с просьбой поддержать такой шаг. Подчеркну, мы сделаем все, чтобы обеспечить безопасные условия для проведения референдумов, для того, чтобы люди могли выразить свою волю. И то решение о своем будущем, которое примет большинство жителей Донецкой и Луганской народных республик, Запорожской и Херсонской областей, мы поддержим.
Just 5 days ago, as he met Prime Minister Modi in Samarkand, Uzbekistan, on the sidelines of the SCO summit, he had accused Ukraine of refusing to negotiate. The Prime Minister, though, told President Putin that it's not the time for war, even though he added that the friendship with Russia remains strong. A statement referred to by French President Emmanuel Macron at the UNGA before President Putin's address to the nation.
Narendra Modi, the Prime Minister of India, was right when he said, the time is not for war. It is not for revenge against the West or for opposing the West against the East. It is the time for a collective time for our sovereign equal states to cope together with challenges we face.
The US, too, welcoming the move by India, a country that has taken a neutral position on the Ukraine crisis so far, to call for cessation of hostilities.
I think what Prime Minister Modi said, a statement of principle on behalf of what he believes is right and just, was very much welcomed by the United States.
Even as the West has already rejected any referendum, calling it a sham ballot, Russia has called 300,000 reservists as it makes the move, which West believes is to annex more Ukrainian territory in the face of the reverses suffered in Kharkiv last week. Bureau Report, NDTV.
All right, a day when tensions in Ukraine have gone up even higher, if at all that was possible, following Vladimir Putin's statements. We're going to take a short break. More coming up.